Welcome to Professor Todd Landman's podcast series. In the second of two podcasts about the contributions that social science methods can make to robust human rights research, Todd talks about comparing countries' human rights records, the benefits of quantitative and qualitative methods, and the importance of getting the research question right.
Well, the key things really are there's a trade-off for me between the sort of level of conceptual abstraction that one has and the scope of countries that you want to compare. First and foremost, if you're thinking about doing a general study around empirical relationships, let's say between levels of development and human rights protection, that's something that could be analyzed using a very large number of countries, let's say all the countries in the world, over 30 or 40 years of time. And the consideration there is that you are sacrificing the specificity for the general. You can use quantitative analysis, statistical analysis, you can control for many factors, you can get stylized statistical results that give you answers that are of a very general nature. Countries with higher levels of economic development tend to have a better protection of political and civil rights, for example, is one of the key findings from that kind of approach. But as you move down the ladder of abstraction, you also lose the ability to include a very large scope of countries. So your concepts become more specific, the number of countries they apply to become smaller, and equally when you go into single case work, your level of abstraction is even lower and your empirical focus is even smaller.
So is it possible to say if one method's better than the other?
It depends on the types of questions that you're asking. If I'm asking a very general question about relationship between development and human rights, I may want to use a large end study, complement it with some small end comparison, and maybe single out a single case study. But there's nothing that says you have to do a large end study or a small end study. Equally, if you have a very specific research question, perhaps, you know, why particular sets of rights were violated in a particular country, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do a large end comparative study. However, I always urge my colleagues and my students to think about what does the literature from other approaches tell you about this problem. So I want my students to read large end studies. I want them to read small end studies and small case studies, and then look at that conversation along that continuum so that they their studies are better informed.
Would you say it's possible for a single country study to make a wider contribution when it comes to the explanation and understanding of human rights problems?
Absolutely. I advocate for this a lot in my writing. And there's a great example I can give you. There's a colleague of mine named Darren Hawkins, who wrote a book about authoritarian rule in Chile. And after examining about 45,000 internal documents of the military period in Chile, he made a very interesting argument about human rights in Chile. He said, look, there were factions within the military. We often think of military regimes as monolithic state apparatus. When in fact he found factions, there was a kind of rule-oriented faction in the military and a more authoritarian, less rule-based faction in the military. And those two factions traded off one another during the period of military rule, where the rule-oriented faction became more and more worried about the legitimacy of the state in the face of increased mobilization from the human rights community. So there was domestic mobilization joined by international mobilization condemning the regime for the types of practices it was carrying out. And this rule-oriented faction began to gain a certain amount of power internally within the military, and there were real sort of calls for some sort of reform, because just prolonged authoritarianism with no let-up was becoming increasingly illegitimate in the eyes of this faction. So he shows in the case of Chile that these factions, in a way, had a bit of a rational game with one another. They were responding to external conditions, domestic and international mobilization for human rights, and then they were playing a game against each other, which ultimately led to a democratic transition in that country. Now, you know, yes, there are specific facts, the Chilean case, that inform that study, but I think there are larger inferences about, well, if we look at authoritarian states, if we look at the Arab Spring countries, for example, there's a really interesting lesson, let's say, within Egypt, between the different factions in Egypt, and now, after the transition and the elections and the Muslim Brotherhood and all those sorts of issues, you can look at who are the stylized sets of actors, how are they responding to external developments, and how do the strategic interaction between those different factions yield different political outcomes. And it's that sort of interaction between the strategic rational and the sort of normative claims being made around human rights that I think the Hawkins study is fascinating. And what's interesting in the book is that he does well, most of the book is on Chile, but in the end he says, oh, well, what we've learned from Chile, I'm now going to apply to Cuba and South Africa. So my model explains why there's not been a transition in Cuba and there has been one in South Africa. So he himself is saying there's value in the case study, and I'm going to show you how.
Let's talk now then a little bit about the differences, you mentioned them earlier, between quantitative and qualitative research when it comes to studying human rights problems. Can you start by explaining the differences?
Well, the words themselves are, you know, exceedingly different. I mean, quantitative approaches are about that which can be enumerated. So a quantitative researcher will say, what can I count? And once I've counted something, what does the distribution in that count look like? So if I'm counting violence in Syria, for example, we've had a new UN report on the number of people reported killed in Syria. The number is 191,000 people. Well, we can put time on that, for example, so we can see what that looks like over time. We can also differentiate it by gender and see if there's a, in fact, they have done, and they show that the victims are predominantly male, for example. In other contexts, we might find that victims are predominantly female. A quantitative analyst will always try to enumerate concepts, to count things, and to look for differences between groups. Particularly in the human rights research, always looking for differences to see if there's some sort of disproportionate treatment or experience that people have that could be interpreted as a problem for human rights. So quantitative researchers are always looking for systematic ways to count things, but also to use more advanced techniques to look for relationships between things that have been counted. The qualitative researcher will say, every moment of quantification begins with a qualitative judgment. And I believe that. I think that when you take a concept from social science like democracy or human rights or those which are essentially contested concepts, you have to make a start qualitatively, defining the terms, defining the limits of the terms, and giving counting rules so that you can go out and count stuff. So there's no question in my mind that there is a qualitative moment before there's a quantitative one. But qualitative researchers go further, maybe less focused on explanation and more focused on understanding. So what do things mean to people? How do people experience things? How do people talk about those experiences? Narrative approaches are great at sort of capturing stories and experiences of people and then analyzing them systematically. And I think there's a false dichotomy, if you will, between the two approaches. They can be in conversation with one another. And for those qualitative practitioners who raise the number of observations beyond, you know, a certain small number of cases, find that they then kind of move into quantitative approaches, right? So they think, well, actually, I've collected 1,000 narratives. The best way to analyze 1,000 narratives is probably to try to look at some content analysis software, look at frequency counts of words, look for meaning in sentences across many observations, etc. So there's a quantitative impulse if you get up, if you increase the number of observations. And equally, I think there should be a qualitative impulse in our quantitative researchers thinking about how they define concepts and operationalize them for statistical analysis.
What are the key things you would like academics and indeed all those engaged in this type of research to bear in mind when it comes to the intrinsic value of methods in addressing important real world issues?
There's a very interesting debate around how we study things. And there was a sort of long debate in American political science and social science more generally about, had the discipline become too scientific, too rational, too quantitative, had we lost sight of the big questions? I do think we need to keep attention to the big questions. And I think that those questions determine the ways we're going to do things. Some questions are particularly well formulated in the idea that there is an answer. There's a putative answer to the question. So when I talk to my students, I always say that, you know, the hardest thing is specifying your research question. You may have a general area of research you want to work in. You may have, particular topics you want to focus on. But unless they can be articulated as real research questions that can be researched, then you're really not off to a good start. Once the question has been well defined, then putative answers can be put on the table, possible answers, right? So there are alternative explanations for the sorts of things that you might be seeing, and you need to remain intellectually honest, open to those alternative explanations. I find many studies are too focused on one particular kind of analysis, and it's always good to be very open-minded early on in a project to allow those alternative explanations to find expression in the way you're going to do your research.
So when a student's trying to put this into practice, what advice do you give them?
When I talk to my students, I say there really ought to be three things you can answer in any one project. What do you want to know? How are you going to find it out? And how would you know if you're wrong? And that's the really big challenge. That third question is about what are the sorts of rules that you put into place in your research project, where if you got an answer from your data, you would actually put your hands up and you say, you know what, my propositions were incorrect. I don't find evidence to support them. And I'm going to have to, you know, look for alternative explanation and reject the hypothesis that I thought was the one that was going to be supported. And I think that honesty, that openness to being wrong and knowing when you're wrong and readjusting your project is absolutely crucial.
Todd Landman was talking to me, Chris Garrington, about social science, methods and human rights, a chapter in the Sage Handbook of Human Rights edited by Anya Meir and Mark Gibney. In his next podcast, we'll be looking at research on how one country's human rights record might be compared to its neighbours and the implications of this for countries and organisations looking to promote human rights. This series is produced by Research Podcasts.